Today, we're very happy that our own Alan Jameson, will be speaking to us. So Alan got his PhD from Washington, and then he spent 6 years at MIT before joining IQC just this year. So his interests include ultra-cold atoms and molecules, quantum information, and also precision measurements. So today, Sir Alan has kindly agreed to tell us about ultra-cold molecules from quantum chemistry to quantum computing. So Alan, whenever you're ready, take it away.
All right. Oh, great. Thanks, Neil. So I wanted to talk to you today about ultra-cold molecules. I started out in atomic physics. Well, I would say still in atomic physics, but slowly came to appreciate molecules. So I wanted to start by just kind of explaining, why do we want to do ultra-cold molecules in the first place? And part of the answer to that question is, ultra-cold atoms are pretty great. So why do we want to go to molecules? So ultra-cold molecules or ultra-cold atoms have been used in quantum simulation, precision measurements. They're starting to come into their own in terms of quantum information and as a platform for quantum computing. So with all those things in their favor, why bother to stick two atoms together trying to make an ultra-cold molecule? And so rather than give you my answer, I'm going to call on a higher authority, which is Bill Anderson. And if you have not had a chance to read this old paper by Anderson called "More is Different," I strongly recommend it. It's a really great read. And in it, he talks about how sort of there's an idea that going to the smallest and smallest things is the only kind of fundamental science to do in physics. And he takes a different perspective and says, no, emergence as you put things together is also a sort of fundamental question. And so if you have this sort of giant of condensed matter theory telling you about how putting things together makes radically new systems with emergent properties, you might expect he's going to talk about something like superconductivity, which he does eventually in the article. But actually, he starts with the ammonia molecule and tells you how there's sort of symmetry breaking involved. You get this inversion transition. And so by sticking four atoms together, you end up with a system that's fundamentally different than a single atom. And what I'd like to share with you and convince you of is that you actually don't even need four atoms. Just sticking two atoms together is enough to give you a very, very different and much richer system. And so a big part of that is that molecules have structure that atoms don't. They have more types of structure. And so for an atom, you would have electronic structure and hyperfine structure. And in a molecule, this is sort of represented by the asymptotes of these curves. So these curves I'm showing here are the electronic interaction potentials on which a molecule sits. And now, in addition to that, they can do what my little animations are doing here. The atoms can vibrate relative to each other, they can rotate around each other. All of this sort of takes place in these potentials. And one thing that you'll see is there's a reasonably good separation of scales. There's sort of a hierarchy here of electronic structure, then vibrational structure, rotational structure. And instead of giving these in energy units, I've given them in units of temperature because the thing that's going to be key is the hyperfine is the sort of lowest energy scale available. And at ultra-cold temperatures, when we're to a microkelvin or below, our temperatures are lower than any energy scale in the structure. And so the reason to take molecules into the ultra-cold regime is that now we have sort of as much control over these variables as we like. Now, one thing that I should say is while there is sort of a hierarchy of scales, there are also interactions within the molecule that couple these scales. Now, I won't have time to go into this in detail, but just as an example, there is spin-rotation coupling in a molecule, which couples the rotational and hyperfine degrees of freedom. And so rotations respond to electric fields. Hyperfine is generally about spins of electrons, which are going to respond to magnetic fields. And so you can couple these degrees of freedom together internally. And one consequence of that is that you can actually simulate fancy ferromagnetism by using this intrinsic coupling of these structures. So molecules have extra structure, and essentially that gives you extra handles for doing quantum simulation. In addition to that, there is sort of a whole other set of ideas you can think about with molecules, which is quantum chemistry. Okay. So banging two atoms together, probably most people would not say that that constitutes chemistry, so, you know, do it the right way, maybe. But banging two molecules together, that's definitely chemistry. So the idea is that you have your two molecules, they collide and something interesting happens at short range, and the dynamics at short range determine what the exit channel of this collision is, which is to say, determine the products of this chemical reaction. And as an example, one goal that we would have for optical chemistry is that we might be able to actually magnetically tune between different product channels. So we could control the outcome of a chemical reaction with a magnetic field. Now, the interesting part of this in terms of dynamics is what happens at short range. And when two molecules collide, or even when an atom and a molecule collide, it can be the case that there are so many different degrees of freedom that the particles spend a very long time in short range with each other. It's sort of exploring the available degrees of freedom, and this is referred to as a collision complex. And so what we'd like to do with ultracold chemistry is maybe learn about those dynamics. And just to give you a bit of a taste for where we're going with this, those collision complex dynamics can in fact be complex. Not where the name comes from, but it turns out to work as well. So this is just a classical trajectory simulation of a diatomic molecule colliding with an atom. A lot of stuff happens, and what comes out is a different molecule, which is rotating, and a different. So trying to understand the complexity of those short-range dynamics is still a very open question in quantum chemistry. Okay, so that's why we want to make ultracold molecules. They open up a lot of new avenues of exploration. So then the question is, how? How do you make a molecule ultracold? So one option you might think of is directly cooling the molecules. So laser cooling of atoms worked really well. It's easier to cool atoms than molecules if you laser cool. But essentially what you want to do is you want to look for the most atom-like molecules you can. So essentially all those extra degrees of freedom that allow us to do a lot of really cool things with molecules that we couldn't do with atoms. Those extra degrees of freedom also make laser cooling much harder. Okay, so in fact, it's way easier to laser cool an atom than a molecule. So this is an example of how a molecule has been directly laser cooled. I'm assuming there aren't many experimentalists here, but if you were, this would make your blood run cold. So normally when I'm laser cooling an atom, I need one laser, maybe two frequencies, some sidebands, something like this. This, if I'm counting right, I think this is four lasers. I think they do manage to do these two with the same laser, but four completely different lasers. Then on top of that, they have different polarizations on different sidebands of those lasers. This is called RF mont because there's a magnetic field that has to switch at megahertz, and the polarizations have to switch at megahertz. So from where I sit in the cold atoms lab, this looks really hard. Okay. So this is an option, though. This is data from the Doyle group at Harvard. There are several groups. Dave DeMille's group at Yale was the first to really show a magneto-optical trap, so genuine 3D laser cooling of a molecule. But it's slow going and it's hard work. It's not the tack that we took. We capitalized on a great realization, which is that molecules are made of atoms. And if atoms are easier to laser cool, maybe we just laser cool a couple of atoms and then stick them together into a molecule. And using coherent control, you can actually take two ultracold molecules, and stick them together into an ultracold molecule without heating up the sample. So this idea originates at Gila in Boulder. From Debbie Jin and Jun Yi's group. And it's basically a two-step process. So going straight from two free atoms to a deeply bound ground state molecule is a bit too far of a step. But you can use a magnetic field sweep to associate them into a very loosely bound molecule, and then use a pair of laser fields to transition that into a deeply bound molecule. And that's where we want to be. We want to be in sort of the ground state where this molecule is still. So I'm going to blow that up a little bit. I want to step you through this plan because there's a good deal of interesting physics that goes on in producing this ground state molecule. And to be a little more specific, for those of you who are molecule aficionados, we're working with sodium-lithium molecules. It's not something that your chemist friends will have much interest in, but it's something that we can make at a microkelvin or below. The relevant potentials, so there's a singlet potential which goes down off the screen, way below the screen. That's sort of the lowest energy electronic potential. What we're actually interested in is the triplet potential, this red curve here. And the reason that we're interested in this is that the triplet potential, triplet molecule, has a non-zero magnetic moment. And so in addition to being able to manipulate rotational, vibrational degrees of freedom, all these new degrees of freedom, we also have an old friend from ultracold atoms, which is the magnetic moment of the atom, or in this case, the molecule. And so that's a handle we already know how to use. We'd like to be able to apply that to the molecular case. And so the way that this assembly plan works is with a magnetic field sweep, we take two free atoms and stick them together into this very loosely bound molecule. You can see how far this wave function goes out. And then use two photons with an excited molecular state as an intermediate to make this ground state molecule, which is much, much smaller in extent. Okay, so let's look at the first step, which is this magnetic field sweep. So we're going to just focus on how do we get to this molecular state. And I've used this term, Beschbach molecule here, which I'll explain. So we're going to sweep the magnetic field, stick these guys together. So the way that this works, we start with some atomic states, these two, which have a different magnetic moment than a molecular state of the same two atoms. So there's some spin up version of the triplet molecule whose energy goes up as you increase the magnetic field, and these two atoms both spin down, their energy is going to decrease. And at some point, those energies will cross. And so you have a point where the energies for the atomic and molecular states cross. So that in and of itself is not interesting. It has to be there somewhere. A little more interesting when you find out this is a field we can reach in the lab. So for sodium lithium, it's a bit of a pain to reach. But fine, we can do it. The interesting physics comes from the fact that there is some kind of coupling between the atomic states and this molecular state. And when you couple these two things at their crossing, that crossing turns into an avoided crossing. Okay, there's some resonance when the energies are equal. That gives you an avoided crossing. And now what we can do is start in this atomic state, the high magnetic field, and then slowly reduce the magnetic field down. If we do this slowly enough, then we won't cross here. We will adiabatically follow this curve, and we'll end up in a molecular state. And so just by adiabatically sweeping the magnetic field, we can go from free atoms to bound molecule. As I said, this is sort of a big, not so tightly bound molecule, but once you go from a continuum state to a bound state, you've made a lot of it. Now that we're in a molecular state, okay, so now we're sitting here in this molecular state, the next step is to use two photons to basically take out all the binding energy. Okay? So this distance from the weakly bound state to the ground state we want to be in, this is about 300 kelvins of energy available here. And so if you just sort of let this relax, your one microkelvin sample of molecules would suddenly become a room temperature sample of molecules, which is a lot of fun in a lot of cases, but that's not what we're looking for. We want to keep our molecules at a microkelvin. And so basically the frequency difference of these two photons is going to match the binding energy, and that's where the binding energy goes. So let's just sort of take some of this molecular structure away. We don't need all of this to understand what's going on. You go to like a little more simplified picture, right? So we start here, this is our intermediate state. We end up down here. This is more complicated than one. Yeah, that's the ticket. Okay, so this is how I want to think about this molecular system. So F is this Feshbach molecule. And I should have said the reason it's called a Feshbach molecule is that magnetically tuned crossing is referred to in atomic physics as a Feshbach resonance. So this Feshbach molecule is loosely bound molecule here. We've got the excited state that's our sort of intermediate, and we've got the ground state we want to end up in. Now, the other thing about this excited state, which hasn't got a name, is that it can radiatively decay. And we don't want this to happen. Okay? If it radiatively decays, it can land in any of a number of different molecular states. And we want to be sure it fits the ground state that we're looking for. So out of deference to the fact that it does something we don't like, we just don't give it a name. And so what I want to explain is how we can make this transition without ever populating that state. So if I make a couple of approximations, which are very, very good, which is the rotating wave approximation, and then I can switch to the dressed atom picture, or that's a bit of atomic physics to the side. The important thing is that in terms of these three states, we end up with just a simple 3x3 Hamiltonian, which you can diagonalize. And of the eigenstates of that Hamiltonian, one of them will not include this state, which must not be named. And so I don't actually have to give it a name. There is a state which is just the Feshbach molecule and the ground state molecule. And what you'll notice is this state, which we refer to as a dark state because it doesn't include this radiating state, this dark state has some mixture of Feshbach and ground state. And that mixture is exactly controlled by the strengths of these two couplings. So again, we want to use an adiabatic transfer, and what we're going to do is essentially change the powers of these two to change the nature of this dark state from Feshbach to ground. So one thing that comes out of this is there's a fixed ratio for the two couplings is what's called electromagnetically induced transparency. So this is some older data from the lab. And what we're doing here is we're tuning the frequency of this coupling, okay? the green coupling. So we're tuning that frequency while keeping the blue coupling at fixed frequency. If the blue light wasn't on at all, you would just see sort of a smooth loss feature here. And this is, as you tune the frequency, you push to that excited level, it decays into something you don't want, and that gives you this loss feature. But when the blue coupling is on, if the two frequencies are exactly matched to the difference in energy, that radiative decay suddenly turns on. And the reason is you cut it out of the middle. You reach this dark state, which is just an admixture of Feshbach. Now, that's sort of a nice way in the lab to check that our lasers are actually as coherent as we need them to be. But how do we actually make this transition? We use what's called stimulated Raman adiabatic passage, or STRAP. And STRAP is this two-photon process, which the tradition is to say, oh, it's a very counterintuitive pulse sequence. Now, why do you say that? Well, look, I start out in this Feshbach state, and I want to end up in the ground state. But I start in Feshbach state, so the first thing I do is turn on the laser that doesn't talk to the Feshbach state. So that's why it's counterintuitive. You talk to the state you're not populating first. But from the perspective of dark states, this actually makes great sense. Right? You remember that dark state, it's an admixture of Feshbach and ground, and that admixture is controlled by the strengths of these two couplings. If the green coupling is not on at all, then the Feshbach state is definitely the dark state, sort of trivially dark. It just didn't shine any light that it can see. And similarly, if I only turn on the green coupling, turn off the blue, then the ground state that I want to end up in is trivially the dark state. So all we're going to do is just swap the nature of the dark state. So we start with the blue coupling on in the Feshbach state, which is the dark state. And now as we ramp these two couplings past each other in the middle, we end up in this sort of superposition state. And I'll just point out that minus sign is actually important. Here's another perspective on this electromagnetically induced transparency is to say, if you're sort of populating both states and you have equal couplings, then there's a destructive interference when you try to populate the excited state. So the coherence of this process is important. And now as I keep moving through this diagram, I get to the end, the ground state is my dark state. And again, as long as this change in the two couplings is done adiabatically, the molecules will just follow that dark state. So the way this ends up working in the lab, as I said originally, we start at a magnetic field a little above the Feshbach resonance. We sweep the field down and produce these Feshbach molecules. Then we apply this Dirac pulse, this sort of out of order seeming, but now you know it's not so funny, pulse sequence. That brings them to the ground state. There's a step called clean because the Feshbach formation process is not very efficient. So there's a bunch of free atoms hanging out, and those free atoms will cause us problems later on. So we blow them all away with resonant light, do the experiments we care about, and then we reverse the whole thing. We reverse the Dirac process to go back up to the Feshbach level. We jump the magnetic field up so that the Feshbach molecules fall apart, and then we image the atoms. So this last bit seems like a lot of work, but it turns out that for the same reason we don't want to laser cool these molecules, we also can't image them very well. So you could just shine light on them and take a picture. Unfortunately, you get on average a photon and a half before the molecules landed in the state that you didn't want them to be in. So to avoid that, we just go back to free atoms, and it's easy to image free atoms. And so we get a bunch of light from those free atoms. So now, let me just show you how we verify in the lab that we've really made ultra-cold molecules this way. So we take this process and we cut it in certain spots. So we sort of proceed, stop, jump to the dissociation field and reduce the atoms. And so what you'll see is we've made Feshbach molecules, and when we jump to the dissociation field, they fall apart into free atoms. We image them, and this is what we're counting. Now, as we ramp these Dirac fields on, what you see is just as the couplings cross each other, the Feshbach molecules suddenly disappear. So now at this time, when we jump that dissociation field up, our molecules are in the ground state. They don't see any of this happen. And so they don't become free atoms that we can use. Wait some time, do whatever experiments you like. Now, as we reverse the Dirac process back, again, you'll see at the crossing point of the couplings, you suddenly see atoms again, which means we've now taken them out of the ground state back into the Feshbach state, which dissociates the image. So this is sort of the gold standard for seeing, yes, we've really made ultra-cold ground state molecules. The ratio of the sort of final atom count to the initial count tells you about the efficiency of your Dirac process. This is some of our first data. We actually can do about 98% efficiency for the Dirac process now, so that works quite well. And so that's how we make ultra-cold ground state molecules. And maybe before we go on to the next topic, we can stop. Just if there are questions, go ahead and ask.
So I don't see any hands raised. Yeah. You can just go ahead, I guess, Alan. Oh, actually, though, like one thing I was just wondering. So could you actually maybe turn off your camera? Because the audio is somewhat choppy.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. We'll see that if that helps.
Okay, great. So we've got these ultra-cold molecules, and now what we're interested in doing with them is ultra-cold chemistry. So there's a fine tradition in physics of physicists going into other people's fields, assuming that you can make a number of wild approximations and then telling everyone how they should do whatever it is that they do for a living. I in that vein, you know, you should be a little concerned when I, as a physicist, come along and say, hey, I want to tell you about chemistry. But nonetheless, we're going to forge ahead. So let me tell you a little bit about chemistry, how it all works. So let me start by sort of giving you a wild oversimplification, which is to say chemistry is just scattering. What do I mean by that? So I don't mean the sort of obvious thing, which is, hey, it's simple, it's just stuff running into each other. What I mean more is that scattering can be an entry point for a physicist trying to understand chemistry and what chemists do. So to give you a bit of a picture here, so on the left, this is a decent molecule dragging a vesicle down a microtubule. This is an important biological process. Yeah, but that's a molecule doing chemistry. So we're probably not going to understand that in terms of scattering. But we can start in that direction by thinking about scattering between a molecule and an atom. And as I sort of teased earlier, this can get pretty complicated pretty quickly when you try to understand these dynamics. So to get a purchase on this, we'll step back even a little bit more to this Schwechbach resonance that I introduced before. And the verbiage that we want here is of channels, right? And so probably a lot of you, this is old hat. You know, you say, I'm going to do some scattering. There are different parameters for the entrance channel, which in this case, what I'm thinking of as channels, these correspond to molecular potentials here that the atoms interact on. And so if I'm at some particular magnetic field, the molecular state that's of interest is this this orange guy here. And what I've marked in blue in the dash is the sort of the energy of free atoms on the blue potential. And now as I tune the magnetic field, basically what I'm doing is I'm tuning these two potentials relative to each other. And so as I move that magnetic field higher, the orange potential, which is the bound potential, moves up. The blue moves down, and this point where you have the Schwechbach resonance is a point where the free atoms have the same energy as one of the bound states. And now, dynamically, a way to think about this, this is a resonant scattering process. And so these two atoms come together, they vibrate back and forth, sort of crossing between these two channels, but only one channel is open. There's only one channel through which they can escape. And so after a short time vibrating together in that bound state, they move back apart on the open channel. And that's sort of all that you can expect to happen when two atoms collide. However, once you move to three bodies, three atoms, it all becomes much, much more complicated. And so what I'm showing you here is pictures from a paper by John Bone's group at Boulder. And what it shows essentially is classical trajectories calculations. So you start off with an atom and a molecule, you send them together on the correct potential energy surfaces, and then just follow the dynamics classically. And what you see on the left is sort of at 1,000 Kelvin, you have what looks like a pretty simple scattering process, right? The atom and molecule come in, they come back out, it's maybe a different molecule, but not much happened. And as you turn the temperature down to 100 Kelvin, suddenly this starts to look more interesting. Now what's happening here in terms of that previous picture that we had of the Schwechbach resonance is you're starting to close some of your channels. So at 1,000 Kelvin, you've got enough energy on the way in that you can escape on almost any channel that comes out of these sort of convoluted interaction surfaces. But as you go down to 100 Kelvin, you've closed a lot of those. And so what you can picture is the atom and molecule collide. They do what I sort of suggested on the Schwechbach resonance, which is they start moving into a different channel where maybe they vibrate around or rotate around each other, but they can go from that channel to yet another channel. So going to an atom and a molecule gives you so many potential exit channels that the dynamics can get extremely complicated as they sort of explore the available channels. as you turn the temperature down, more and more of those channels are closed. And so it can take a long time for the, again, I'll say three atoms, because once they get at short range, calling it a molecule and an atom is not really fair. It's three atoms all interacting very strongly. That dynamics can take a longer and longer time. And so you see, once you get down to this one Kelvin picture, the simulation runs out of juice before the exit channel is actually found. So this gray dot here is not like a censorship dot. This is every imaginable part of that space is being explored. And so you can't even resolve in the end. So what we want to do is try to understand this dynamics. And again, the sort of simple picture that I give you is when two molecules collide, or even a molecule and an atom, you have the formation of this complex, and the dynamics in there determine what the exit channel is. Now, unfortunately, we can't see the dynamics of the collision complex directly. All we can see is how many of our initial scattering states, or let me now say our initial reactants, we can see how many of them we start with, we can see how they disappear with time, and from that we can infer things about the exit channel, things about the rates of these reactants. So the platform that we work with, I mentioned it briefly earlier, is triplet sodium-lithium molecules. So we're working with a triplet state of a sodium-lithium molecule. As you see, we're in the vibrational ground state of this potential. We're also in the rotational ground state. So the particular hyperfine state we're in is actually highest energy hyperfine state. But nonetheless, what I'm showing you here on the plot to the right is simply that these molecules live a long time. Now, you might have been worried about that initially because this is an electronically excited state, right? The singlet potential, as I said, goes quite far down, like 10,000 Kelvin more energy to get to the bottom of the singlet potential. Nonetheless, it's metastable with a very long lifetime. And so we see in the lab, yes, there's a long lifetime. Good. So we know that just on their own, these molecules will have a long lifetime. Now the question is, what happens when I add some atoms in? So what I'm going to add in is sodium atoms. And the reason I want to add sodium is that if I added lithium in, which is the other atom I have on hand, right, sodium and lithium, there's always an allowed reaction between lithium and triplet state sodium. But with sodium, there are a couple of possibilities. Now, two of them end up in very deeply bound molecules. So these are reactions that can definitely happen. Okay, so one thing that can happen when the sodium-lithium triplet and the sodium atom collide is that one of these spins can flip to form a sodium singlet molecule, sodium 2, or it could flip to form a singlet sodium lithium molecule. Each of these are bound by dramatically higher binding energy than the triplet sodium lithium molecule. But if none of the spins flip, the only other thing that could happen is to form a triplet sodium 2 molecule. And that's actually at higher energy, so that has less binding energy. Realize I've used wave numbers on here because I was really trying to convince people that I knew something about time speed. So 50 wave numbers corresponds to 1.5 terahertz of energy. And so for comparison, we work at 2 microkelvin, which is like 50 kilohertz of energy. So there's no way for these to collide at 1 or 2 microkelvin and form this molecule. So what this has sorted itself into is a set of product states that can definitely be reached energetically, but require a spin flip, and a product state that cannot be reached energetically without a spin flip. And so the question is, energetically, yes, these are definitely allowed. Do the dynamics in the collision complex allow this? And if you remember this idea that there's a mess at short distance when you have these very low temperature collisions, the prevailing wisdom from a number of theorists was that anything that is not strictly forbidden by conservation laws is possible. And so we would expect to throw the sodium atom in and see one of these product states formed and the molecules disappear. And Indeed, that's what happens. If you add in the sodium malt atom at a slight tilt of the spin, then you see a very rapid loss of molecules. And the scale of this plot is sort of tipping my hand here. If instead we put in the sodium atom completely spin polarized so that it's aligned to the molecule, we see a dramatically longer lifetime. In fact, we see a lifetime that's it's not so different than what we see when there are no sodium atoms at all. And so this is some older data that just sort of shows the principle very, very cleanly, that we have a much longer lifetime when these are completely spin aligned. But again, if we tilt by just the smallest amount, one step down on the Zeeman ladder, now there is some spin down character to the sodium atom, and these chemical reactions go very, very rapidly. Now, on making sort of cleaner measurements, what we found is that, sympathetically cool, which would be fantastic, because again, molecules are hard enough to cool on their own. If we could sympathetically cool them, use these sodium atoms to cool the molecules, that would be great. But that requires this elastic to inelastic ratio of at least 50. So for every inelastic collision, you have to have at least 50 elastic collisions. Now, there's a few reasons to want sympathetic cooling. One is that cooling to degeneracy, the quantum degeneracy, always requires collisions. So there have been some very nice experiments recently of laser cooling to quantum degeneracy, but even in those experiments, in fact, you need some collisions at the end to redistribute energy between different degrees of freedom. So any cooling to degeneracy requires some kind of collision. Now, people have looked for collisional cooling. And under collisional cooling, I'm including both sympathetic cooling, where the molecules just sort of hang out and sodium atoms collide with them to cool them down, or evaporative cooling, where the molecules have lots of good collisions with themselves and can sort of cool themselves. So people have looked for this sort of collisional cooling of molecules before, but it's never been seen below about 50 millikelvin. We're working at 2 microkelvin, so we're quite far from that region. And again, we need an elastic to inelastic ratio greater than 50. In our most recent work, what we've found is that we have a ratio of about 300. And so we now can say, yes, we have the right ratio. We should look for sympathetic cooling. And in fact, we see it. So what I'm showing you here in this plot is the temperature for a sequence where we produce our ultracold molecules in the presence of a bath of sodium atoms. And the process of producing the molecules actually heats them a bit. So not by 300 Kelvin, which would be terrible, but by about a Kelvin. And so, actually, a bit less than that. So what we've done here is we've let the sodium atoms cool a bit further, and then we watch what happens to the molecules. So the blue is if we blow away the sodium before this time, so there is no sodium to cool the molecules, and you can see the temperature wanders a bit in the data, but essentially, the temperature is fixed over the course of a second. And the sodium, when the sodium is present, its temperature is about a microkelvin lower than the molecule. So in the presence of sodium, you get these red points, which shows you that the temperature of the sodium with the molecules rapidly falls down to meet the sodium. And so this is at 200 milliseconds. There's a break on the scale just to let you know these things stay cold. There's no sort of exciting in a bad way, kind of heating going on at long times. These molecules cool down and they stay there. And again, this is just showing that the loss with the sodium present is not that much faster than the molecules just sort of disappear on them. So that looked like sympathetic cooling. We were pretty excited, but you know, this is a pretty big deal, particularly since people had sort of predicted roughly that this should not work for our system. So we said, okay, let's be sure nothing funny is going on. how about if we sympathetically heat? Okay, if this is a result of elastic collisions, we should be able to pull the molecules in either direction. Whereas if they were, you could imagine some technical problem where they would naturally do one thing. So what we did here is we modulated the trap. So I haven't said much about the nuts and bolts of the experiment. The molecules and the atoms are sitting together in an optical dipole trap. Okay, so this is a high-powered laser that is focused down, and the atoms and molecules both naturally pull toward the focus of the laser. And so what's that trap looks more or less harmonic in the bottom, which is where they sit. And so we can modulate the trap at the trapping frequency of the sodium atoms. So sort of the frequency at which they'd roll back and forth in the trap. If we modulate the trap at that frequency, we'll selectively heat up the sodium atom, because the sodium has a different trap frequency than the molecule. Okay. So the point being, if we have the molecules in the sodium before this heating process, they sit at about this temperature, just over 1.5 microkelvin in this case. You modulate the trap that heats the sodium up to 2 microkelvin. And it also excites the cloud, it messes with the overlap a bit, so you don't see like a nice smooth exponential approach. But as the excitations in the sodium cloud are thermalized, you see the temperature of the molecules rises up to meet the temperature of the sodium. And again, the time scale is about the same as it was for the cool. On the other hand, the blue points, the blue circles here are, if you blow away the sodium right after that heating process, then you see that the temperature of the molecules does not change. So we've now seen very clearly, if you have no sodium, the molecule temperature stays fixed. If you have sodium that's hotter than the molecules, the temperature of the molecules rises. If you have sodium that's at a lower temperature than the molecules, the temperature of the molecules drops. So at this point, we feel pretty good. The last thing that you could say is, if it's real sympathetic cooling, the payoff should be that we can increase the phase space density of the sample. And so the phase space density is just sort of a measure of how close to quantum degeneracy are we. And indeed, when we do a careful evaporation ramp, there's some details about the evaporation ramp that are a bit funny, and you can find them in our paper that just came out a few weeks ago. But essentially, we can increase the phase space density by a factor of 20. Or you could say we can 20 times closer to quantum degeneracy than we started. So that's shown here. This is just a phase space density plot. There's sort of a normal evaporation ramp that gets us, you know, a factor of 5. And then this sort of more convoluted ramp gets us a factor of 20 compared to the initial phase space density. So that's great. We now have a tool for cooling molecules after they're produced, which had not been done before in the ultra-cold regime. So this is all predicated on some sort of quantum chemistry, really. We have seen that we can spin control the chemistry, right? If we tilt the sodium spin at all, there are violent chemical reactions, but in the perfectly spin aligned case, those reactions are turned off. Now, what we'd like to do moving forward is learn more about those collision complex dynamics. And essentially the way to do that is to look at reactions with slightly different reactant states. Change the spin tilt of the molecule rather than the atom. Look at rotations of the molecule, this sort of thing. And for a very long time, I thought, hey, this is pretty cool if you can control chemistry by controlling the spin of the reactant. And I would always say, chemist, is there a reaction for which this is meaningful? Like, would you guys be excited by this? And I always get kind of like, well, no, not really. Finally, I've met a chemist who told me a great reaction that's spin controlled. So there's some funny purple things here, which are chiral molecules. Those are way bigger than I want to think about in terms of molecules. I can't laser cool this for sure. The chemical reaction, though, is a very important one, which is the electrolysis of water. And so part of electrolysis of water is the formation of an O2 molecule. And oxygen is a triplet state molecule. So to form an O2 molecule in this electrolysis process, the spins of the two oxygen molecule atoms have to be aligned. And so to just get a little bit of a flavor of this chemistry, what essentially happens is the electric field in the cell breaks the water into an H plus, which takes off in one direction, takes off the anode. And then the OH minus, which is left behind, this hydroxide ion, drops an electron off at the anode and ends up as a hydroxyl radical. Now, if the hydroxyl, if two hydroxyl radicals with opposite spins come together, they can make peroxide. And peroxide, while it may be useful at home, it's not useful for this reaction. That's sort of a broken attempt to make hydrogen and oxygen out of electrolysis. But these chiral molecules, it turns out they can preferentially take an electron with a certain spin. And so this will essentially spin align, spin polarize the hydroxyl radicals that come off of this anode. And so it turns off this peroxide reaction. So this has actually been shown to make water electrolysis quite a bit more efficient. So it turns out spin control chemistry, while it's really robustly accessible and usable in the ultracold regime, turns out that it's also genuinely useful for what I'm going to call real chemistry, industrial chemistry, useful chemistry. Okay. Now, another thing that we're interested in with these molecules is atom molecule Fischbach resonance. And this, I hinted at this plot was floating around before, but I didn't really explain it. The picture from the classical trajectories calculation of this just gray blob, where you really can't tell what's going on because the atoms spend so much time together in the collision complex. That comes from sort of quantum mechanical picture of many, many overlapping channels, which all can cross at very similar energies. So this sort of quasi plot that I put here on the left is sort of a hint that to say we can have a Fischbach resonance, which is this sort of spike in the loss rate, but we can actually have so many of them that they all overlap, and what you get is just a nearly uniform loss, okay? Just sort of arbitrarily fast reactions. Now, the as you go to smaller mass and smaller van der Waals coefficient for the molecules, the density of states in the collision complex drops. And so you can imagine these resonances start to spread out until they may actually be resolvable. The one thing that we'd like to pursue very soon is to just look as a function of magnetic field. Can we actually tune the chemical reaction rate as a function of magnetic field? Okay, so now is probably another good time to sort of pause and ask for questions. So let me put my video back on.
Okay. So any questions for Alan? Please feel free to raise your hand or to speak up, either way. Okay, I guess not. So we can go on.
All right, great. I will disappear again. Okay. So the last thing I wanted to mention, which unfortunately I'm just going to go through briefly because running short on time, but in addition to extra handles for quantum simulation, in addition to understanding something about chemistry, molecules are also quite useful for quantum computing. And so I'll just briefly sketch the idea here. A sort of workhorse of ultracold atoms experiments is the optical lattice potential. And this is made simply by retroreflecting laser beams to create standing waves of light. The atoms, or as I've drawn them now, molecules, are drawn to the antinodes where these standing waves are brightest. And essentially, you get a regular grid of atoms or molecules, potentially. And this has been used for quantum simulations of condensed matter systems where this optical potential is basically standing in for the potential made by the ionic cores, and the atoms move around in that potential, like the electrons in some material. But the other thing that's a bit just simpler to see is you've got a regular array of these things in place. Now, by doing this with molecules rather than atoms, we have a lot of molecules close together in a very cleanly addressable space. And we can take advantage of something that I haven't really stressed yet. So I stressed all the different handles that molecules give you for quantum simulation. The other thing that they give you that's quite exciting compared to an atom is a permanent electric dipole moment. So a molecule has a strong electric dipole moment. Certain molecules have strong electric dipole moments that allow them to interact with each other from a distance. Whereas in atomic systems, they really have to sort of sit on top of each other to interact. And so with the molecules, putting them in a grid, first of all, would allow us to simulate interesting quantum spin models. In fact, there's a nice paper that shows any spin model can be simulated with the right molecule and the right set of lasers and microwaves. So we can simulate interesting spin models, but we can also use these long interactions for entangling gates in quantum computing. And so just to give you the rosy picture of why you would want to use molecules for quantum computing, they have quite long coherence times. So this is my sort of reasonable, let's say optimistic, but not wild-eyed ideas of how well a molecular quantum computer could work. So the coherence time in a molecular system could be up to about 10 seconds. That's already been demonstrated nearly 1 second coherence times. And I knew the folks who did this research and said, well, you know, that's pretty nice, but did you? And I started reeling off a list of things. Did you look at this, think about that? And honestly, we just tried it. We just took our ambient lab environment. We gave it a go. The system was so robust, we got a second of coherence time. Yeah. So there's certainly room for improvement on that result. That's a great result. Now, the number of qubits that you could reasonably have in this array and address them individually, which is sort of key, is, I would say, 1,000 is a very reasonable prospect. 10,000 is a good bit of engineering going into it, but nothing sort of fundamentally new. And then for single qubit gates, well, I should tell you what the qubit is, in fact. So what I'm envisioning here is that these molecules, like the ones that I've been telling you about, are triplet state molecules, which means they have a spin degree of freedom that we can talk to readily. Now, that's good and bad, because that could mean that the environment talks to it readily as well. But we've got a spin degree of freedom we can talk to with all the normal technology of atomic physics. And so we can do fast Raman pulses to do single qubit gates, and that's a 1 to 10 microsecond type time scale. But of course, single qubit gates are never anyone's limitation. The question is, what's the qubit gate going to look like, and how quickly can we do it? And so the gate I want to describe to you would have, with the right molecule, which in this case would be something like sodium cesium or lithium cesium, so both molecules that can be made in the ultra-cold regime, the time for these two qubit entangling gates should be on the order of about 100 microseconds. So that's assuming a 99% fidelity. And now you can see, at least why I'm excited, is that ratio is 10 to the 5. So if this can really be realized in the lab, this would be a fantastic way to look at quantum information. So just to give you the idea here, if I am sitting in this triplet molecular state, there's two good things about it. One is that I have a spin that I can hang on to. And the other thing is that it does not have a strong electric dipole moment. So certain states of molecules have strong electric dipole moments. That electronic ground state, the singlet state, that has a strong electric dipole moment. So the triplet state, you can sit there and, again, maybe you worry about external magnetic fields talking to your molecules, but what you don't have to worry about is the molecules talking to each other. So I can use the two spin states as my 0 and 1. And what I'm going to do here is essentially a controlled NOT gate. So on this molecule is the target qubit, and let's say it started in the 1 state. And then we're going to follow the possibilities for it starting in the 1 state and this guy either being in the 0 or the 1. Okay. We'll just sort of follow them together. So if this is in the 0 state, then it will be transferred to the dipolar singlet state, whereas one will not. Now, what this does is it shifts the standard level. So the dipolar interaction between two neighboring molecules in the singlet state is quite strong. And essentially the idea is that interaction will shift whether or not the singlet state can be resonantly reached from this molecule. So your target qubit is going to say, hey, if this was in the one state, I can go down here. No problem, because I'm still in resonance. But if the control qubit was in the zero state, it's sitting here, it's shifted this off resonance, and now I cannot get down to the single state. So we essentially do a round trip from one to zero, but that can only be done for the target qubit. If the control qubit starts out in one, then you lift your control qubit back and you've made your control node. So we're rushing through that a bit, but be happy to take more questions about it. And I'll just briefly mention, if you have friends, colleagues who are looking to do some experimental atomic physics, as Neil said at the beginning, I just recently started at ITC, building a new lab for doing ultracold molecules and looking for postdocs and graduate students. And so with that, let me just give credit to the team that worked with me on this at MIT in the group of Wolfgang Ketterle. Humak Sun was the senior grad student, and Julie Park is the junior grad student who in the relatively near future will be taking over as senior student. And with that, I can take any more questions.
Okay, great. Thanks, Alan. It's very exciting. okay. So are there any questions for Alan? So normally we start with student questions, although of course I can't see who's a student or not. Okay, well, I'm not sure if there are any students present, so we'll open it up to questions from anybody. Okay, I'm not seeing any hands raised, so hopefully people are familiar, you know, with the, you know, with the Zoom functionality. Okay, well, if there's no questions, well then let's thank Alan again. I can applaud.